Rolling Stone magazine has called the band Blitzentrapper the best Grateful Dead knockoff in forever. True enough, but frankly, that shortchanges what this band is doing. Drifting down the sleepy river, waking like a child. You're never gonna know what the spirit says. Blitzentrapper's new album is called Fur. The record made Rolling Stone's list of the best albums of 2008, and it also made the list of best CDs of the year in the NPR All Songs Considered listeners poll. Blitzentrapper's songwriter and lead singer is Eric Early, and he came to the studios of Oregon Public Broadcasting in Portland to talk with us. Hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. I understand your dad was a bluegrass musician?
That's right.
And he taught you to play your first instrument?
Oh, yeah. I still got a banjo that he gave me.
Is there a track on this album that features you playing the banjo that we might take a listen to?
Oh, you could play the banjo solo off of Saturday Night. It's kind of fun. That kind of organy sounding thing, accordion sounding thing, is the melodica.
The melodica? What's the melodica? Yeah.
It's a sort of weird German instrument that you blow into. It was used by the Dub Kings, you know, by all the dub guys from Jamaica back in the 70s.
So that, were you playing your dad's banjo there, the one that your dad gave
yeah,
you?
Yeah, that's a Kentucky made.
Tell me about the piano that you wrote most of this stuff on.
I don't even know whose it is. It got left out in the hallway of our studio space, and so me and Brian one day just pulled it into our studio.
Brian's your bandmate?
He's a drummer, yeah. Just kind of had it in there, and I started writing songs on it at night and recording with it. It was a beat-up old thing. We don't have it anymore. We just sort of left it in the hallway when we moved out.
Was there something about composing a song on a piano that sounded terrible that made the songs develop differently?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say it sounds terrible. I mean, it definitely is slightly out of tune, and I mean, I don't know. I think that it sounded unique, and also it was all I had at the studio anyway, so. In my sleep, I'm not your lover anymore.
All I know is in my sleep, I'm not your lover anymore. There's kind of a clicking sound in the background. Is that piano?
Yeah, you can hear the hammers smacking. The thing with that piano is that the front of it had broken off. So you could see the interior of it, the guts of it. And you could also hear it.
When you're on tour and you have a beautifully tuned grand, do you feel a little nostalgic for this old clacker?
Like sometimes, yeah. Although not that much.
I want to ask about your Portland influences. I'm from Portland, Oregon, and I was reading an old interview that one of your bandmates did, and I kind of found the question perfectly phrased, so I'm going to quote directly from this interview that was on brightestyoungthings.com, a blog. And the interviewer said, "This is sort of a backwards way of getting you to say that it's the best state in the union, but how do you think Oregon has affected or influenced you?"
I mean, there's a certain darkness to Portland, the weather and the economy. But I think there's also a certain warmth and familiarity that goes along with it.
Where'd the story of the Black River Killer come from?
It was just a little while past the Sunset Strip. They found the girl's body in an open pit. Her mouth was sewn shut, but her eyes were still wide, gazing through the fog to the other side.
Well, I don't know. I mean, that's kind of like a conglomeration of different ideas. I mean, I was drawing heavily off of, you know, like Cormac McCarthy-style narrative.
The novelist.
But it's also based sort of on my Uncle Tommy, my father's lost brother, who was a criminal, a junkie, and a really sweet guy.
What was his story?
You know, he, as a kid, he was around a little bit, and when we'd visit L.A., you know, he was the guy with the big beard, with the stained T-shirt that was, you know, always, like, playing Rolling Stone songs in my grandfather's back shed, you know. It was dark as the grave, it was just about three, when the warden with his key came to set me free. They gave me
$5 in a secondhand suit, a pistol and a hat and a worn-out blue. So I took the bus down to the Rio Grande, and I shot a man down on the edge of town. Then I stole me a horse and I rode it around till the sheriff pulled me in and he set me down.
And then as I got older, he disappeared. After my grandfather died, he disappeared, and the cops would come to our house in Oregon once a year looking for him. Have you heard from Tommy? We're looking for him. He's pulled a heist in such and such city, you know, that kind of thing. And so I kind of always had this, like, a mythical view of Tom, you know, and, like, you know, he's down on the border, like, running guns, or I don't even know. We haven't heard from him for 10 years, maybe? Not more than that.
Huh.
Probably 15 years.
Did he ever do anything like the Black River Killer in the song?
I don't know. I mean, he didn't kill anybody that I know of. He might have. I have no idea. I think the best story about him that my father used to tell me was in the late 60s, Tommy got on a chain gang for possession. And back then, you know, they would chain him up and they would work, usually digging ditches. And he escaped from the chain gang one afternoon. And he was wearing, you know, his prison garb. And he stole a car and headed back towards my dad's house in East L.A. And he got pulled over. So he's just escaped from a chain gang, stolen a car. And he gets pulled over. And my Uncle Tommy was such a sweet talker that he talked the cop out of the ticket and rolled up into my dad's driveway in a stolen car. And my dad's like, what are you doing here? Yeah.
And did your dad turn him in?
No.
Wow.
Well, the sheriff let me go with a knife and a song. So I took the first train up to Oregon. And I killed the first man that I came upon. Because the devil works quick, you know, it don't take.
I should say we have not played the title track off your album, Fur, and that's because listeners heard it during All Things Considered segment on the best albums of 2008. But if you want to listen to it in full, it's on npr.org. Eric Early of Blitz and Trapper, it's been a pleasure talking with you.
Yeah, likewise. Thank you.
Happy New Year.
Yeah, same to you.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel. Imagine if your hands shook so badly that you couldn't even lift a glass of water. Well, that's what life is like for millions of Americans who suffer from essential tremor disorder. The condition can be devastating if you're a musician. And that was almost the case for guitarist Richard Crandall. The musician found a way to continue composing and performing, as Joel Rose reports.
Richard Crandall started playing guitar when he was a kid, but he didn't really take it seriously until the late 1960s when he heard guitarist John Fahey. For Crandall, it was a revelation.
With an acoustic guitar, you could create a whole orchestra. In other words, I could play these solo pieces that sounded fine just the way they were.
In the early 1970s, Crandall left his job and his marriage in Buffalo, New York. He moved to the West Coast and started writing songs of his own. Crandall settled down in Eugene, Oregon, and eventually opened for Fahey. Crandall's occasional roommate, Mark Zorn, says his friend's guitar rarely left his hands.
He was always practicing. He was always practicing. It was just a joy to have music in the house like that.
Crandall Crandall went on to record half a dozen albums. One of his tunes was even recorded by another of his idols, Leo Kottke. But Crandall never achieved Kottke's level of fame. And these days, the guitar seems to cause him more frustration than joy.
If my life depended on it and I had to play the dance section of Be Good or Be Gone, this is how it would come out. I can't play it.
Richard Crandall was diagnosed 6 years ago with essential tremor disorder. An estimated 10 million Americans live with the condition, which affects fine motor coordination. In Crandall's case, his hands shake when he tries to write, use a computer, or play difficult passages on the guitar. It was around this time that Crandall got a job offer. A local concert promoter asked Crandall to drive a tour bus for Afro-pop star Thomas Mopfumo and his band. But Crandall had never driven a bus before.
I was petrified because I was responsible for the lives of 14 Africans. I was not mechanical. I had a terrible sense of direction, but they trusted me.
Crandall successfully piloted the tour bus from Oregon to Alabama and back, then parked it in front of his apartment.
They had totally cleaned out the bus. I looked under one of the seats, and I found this imbira, and I said, oh, what's this?
The imbira is a traditional thumb piano from Africa. Crandall's comes from Zimbabwe. It's a flat piece of wood that he holds in his hands, with a row of metal strips across the top that he plays with his thumbs. To his surprise, Crandall discovered that his hands don't shake when he plays it.
I didn't say, oh, I've got essential tremor, I better start playing the imbira. I just like the sound of it.
Crandall taught himself how to tune and play the imbira. From the beginning, he says he wasn't trying to play Shona music from Zimbabwe. Still, he was criticized, not by the musicians in Thomas Mopfumo's band, but by other Americans.
There are little pockets of imbira players around the country who play traditional Shona music, and they sort of look down on you if you change the instrument around or do anything else. But the guys in Thomas's band, they loved what I was doing. They say, Richard, play us a new song.
Before long, Crandall was performing his new songs in public. Even his longtime friend Mark Zorn was surprised by how quickly Crandall adapted to the imbira.
I didn't take it seriously until I was wandering around the Saturday market and I heard these shimmering notes, which could only have been from the imbira. As music does, it just turned my head right away and I moved toward the source and there was Richard.
Crandall's songs also caught the ear of Mark Zorn's younger brother, the MacArthur Genius Grant-winning saxophonist, composer, and producer John Zorn, who runs a record label and a club in New York City. In 2004, Zorn brought Crandall to the East Coast to record, and he recruited Brazilian-born Ciro Baptista to join Crandall in the studio. The percussionist says he was impressed by Crandall's sense of restraint.
He plays enough, not more than should be. It's great because he plays living in space. I could play in the betweens with him. The fact that he played guitar before is a plus for him because he has a harmonic concept of the instrument. And plus, he have amazing rhythm.
Baptista and Crandall made two records together. They've gotten strong reviews and even made a few critics' top 10 lists.
I'm grateful to have my little imbira. It turns out that I've gotten more attention on that than I ever got on the guitar.
That started to change in the last few years as more of Crandall's guitar music has been released on CD for the first time. Crandall says it's bittersweet to read glowing reviews of his early work.
I used to not think I was quite good enough, or I didn't realize I had how special what I was doing was. You know, I just kind of took it for granted. So now I've got this other gift, you know, of the imbira and being able to do something with that.
Crandall isn't taking his second act for granted. He He's planning to record a benefit album for the Essential Tremor Foundation, and he has even bigger plans.
My mission at this point is to calm the world with this music because it seems to be so soothing. And I'd love to play for the inauguration if anybody out there is listening.
And if anyone is going to need some soothing music, Crandall figures it's President-elect Barack Obama. For NPR News, I'm Joel Rose.
You can hear a cross-section of Crandall's music, both on guitar and mbira, at nprmusic.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Guy Raz. As we begin the new year, we're looking back at some of the developments of last year in music. It wasn't a great year for CD sales, and several small symphony orchestras had to close down. But there was growth in one corner of the musical universe, American Indian musicians who are embracing classical music. They're drawing as much from the music of Claude Debussy as from traditional American Indian harvest songs. And as NPR's Felix Contreras reports, the music and the musicians are getting noticed.
Composer Timothy Archambault used to play his traditional American wood flute in private, strictly as a way to stay connected with his Kitchissippurini Algonquin ancestors. Then, 3 years ago, he was invited to perform at the first Classical Native Series, sponsored by the Smithsonian Institution's Museum of the American Indian. There, he met other Native composers who wanted to write music for his flute, like George Quincy, who wrote Choctaw Diaries and performed it with Archambault this year. Timothy Archambault says he's been intrigued by what he's heard from other American Indian composers at the Smithsonian gatherings.
The compositions are intellectually stimulating. They're not dismal, kind of one-dimensional works. They have studied the Western tradition, and they study their own American Indian traditions, which are dying out. You hear that merging with Western tonality and harmony, and that is intriguing, and that's something that's totally new.
That's how it was for Chickasaw composer Jared Tate, until his mother, a professor of dance and professional choreographer, asked him to write music for a ballet she created. He'd been studying European classical piano and composition.
I didn't mix my identity of being a very classically trained musician with being an American Indian. I never saw that there was even a possible relationship with those two until I started composing. And that's when those two came together in a way that really made me feel just wonderful.
Since 1992, Tate's been exploring his culture through classical music. And his work has been performed by orchestras in Washington, D.C., Minneapolis, New Mexico, and San Francisco. Tate compares his work to that of contemporary Indian painters who abstract cultural icons, like feathers and horses. He recasts American Indian musical icons, such as flutes and drums. Like many classically trained American Indians, Tate's gone back to explore his culture. And he says the combination of the two musical worlds has an unexpected benefit for tradition.
Not only are American Indians accessing contemporary expressions like this, but they're also going back and learning their traditions very, very well, you know, along with singing and dancing and language. So they're actually both kind of moving parallel with each other.
Mixing European classical with indigenous and folk music is not new. In the late 19th and early 20th centuries, European composers such as Antonin Dvorak and Béla Bartók drew from European folk music. In 1935, Mexican composer Carlos Chávez wrote Sinfonía India, drawing on his country's indigenous music. In the U.S., white classical composer Theodore Baker was one of the first to seriously study American Indian music in the late 1800s. But it would take another half century before American Indians began to embrace classical music to express their cultural identity. In the 1950s, composer Louis Ballard was inspired by Bartók to write chamber, orchestral, and choral music, as well as ballets that incorporated Ballard's Quapaw and Cherokee background. Ballard's work gained acclaim, and he continued to compose until his death 2 years ago. But much of the work of others experimenting with the two styles remained below the radar until 1994, when the first convention of American Indian composers was held in Boulder, Colorado. Since then, composers have received commissions, the American Composers Forum has started a First Nations initiative, and some tribes have even funded education programs for young composers. And the music is getting noticed both on and off the reservation by Indians who prefer country, hip-hop, or heavy metal.
I'm really surprised by how much people have liked it.
Mohawk cellist and composer Don Avery has studied with John Cage and played classical, pop music, and jazz.
One of the reasons is because there's a great appreciation for the sounds of the instruments, but also to hear our traditional music being represented in this way, I think people understand that there's an importance to that.
For Avery, it was the work of American Indian musical elder Louis Ballard, as well as a rediscovery of her heritage, that inspired her to compose with Indian themes. But as she's become more intimate with her culture, she's also felt what she called an emotional tug of war by honoring her ancestors through a culture largely responsible for their subjugation.
It is tricky because I wonder if I'll be able to always play cello. The more I get back to my roots, I don't know if it's going to feel okay, honestly. I don't know. I've gotten farther away from the typically classical music. As much as it's beautiful music, it doesn't move me the same way. It's a little sad. It's a little bittersweet. You know, it's also very exciting, though, because I have all these other sounds in my head now that just vibrate with me better.
Back at the Smithsonian Museum of American Indian Concert Hall, Mescalero Apache composer Stephen Alvarez hopes the classical native movement will offer American Indians a new musical voice in much the same way that reggae and hip-hop have for their cultures.
I would really like to see Native America find that fusion that's going to create its own genre. I'm hoping. Maybe before I die, you know.
Stephen Alvarez and many American Indian composers say the new music they're creating offers a tool to dispel more than 200 years of stereotypes. Felix Contreras, NPR News.
And you can hear more of that new music at npr.org.
An icon of American journalism was laid off this week, Nat Hentoff. His most recent job was with the Village Voice newspaper in New York. The 83-year-old Hentoff had been associated with the paper for 6 decades. When we talked to him, he said the condolences poured in immediately.
It's like reading one's obituary while you're still alive.
Well, how does it feel to have reached this point 60 years after you started writing for the Village Voice?
Well, I can't say it's exhilarating, but I've been through this before. I have been fired from some of the more prestigious publications over the years.
Is that so?
So I can understand the tone of voice when I get the call. One of my favorite ones was I was at the New Yorker magazine for over 25 years under the legendary William Shawn. He left. He was fired. And when Tina Brown came in, it was about 10 days before Christmas, I got a note from her managing editor thanking me for my service. Now that I had retired, it was very kind of her because I hadn't been aware I'd retired.
You are certainly not the only prominent journalist to have been laid off in the last few years, but you are among the most prominent. And I wonder what you think this says about the state of media and newspapers today.
Well, that's very troubling. Those papers in those small towns, some of them are folding. And that means, of course, the Internet, which is fine, except what you get most of the time is people going to those sites and those blogs with which they already agree.
Right.
So that bothers me in terms of what James Madison said, I'm paraphrasing. If people do not understand the history of the country, the nature of the Constitution, if they're not an informed citizenry, and I'm paraphrasing very badly here, we've blown the gig. It's hard to keep a republic if the citizens don't know why they are different from other countries. And I think that's a key problem now.
Do you have any advice for young journalists who are starting out their career at this point?
The main thing is, if you're passionately interested in something, and we all are in one or more things, that's something that's an area you ought to really get familiar with. And if you can go into interviews to begin with a real knowledge of what you're asking the interviewee, the other thing I'd have to tell them is what one of my mentors, Izzy Stone, told me when I was in my 20s. He said, if you think you're in this business to change the world, go get another day job. Because if you do change anything, it'll be incremental, and you may not even know that it happened. But if you have this insistence, once you get a story that has to be told, to follow it, that's why you're there. Don't worry about your becoming part of the story.
You know, you joked at the beginning of this conversation that this experience has almost been like reading your obituary. And I wonder, as folks who are now looking back on the last 60 years that you've spent at the Village Voice, look at the body of work you've created. Is there any subject you've written about or column you wrote that you would like people to visit and reread in particular?
Well, I can tell you, it's another way of answering this. It's very hard to know when you write or when you broadcast whether you're really reaching people in a way that makes a real difference to them. And a few years ago, there was a big conference in New York of lawyers, and all these lawyers from around the country were there, and I was sitting at the table with them, and three lawyers came over. They looked to be in their 30s or so, and one speaking for all of them looked at me and said, I want to tell you why we're here. When we were all in high school, we were reading you in The Voice, and you made the law so exciting that's why we're here. My goodness, that was a great thing to hear.
Well, before you wrote about politics and the law, you wrote about music, and I wonder if there's a song you would like us to go out on that maybe describes your career or that's just a personal favorite.
One of Duke Ellington's songs, Things Ain't What They Used to Be, and that is, of course, continually what we are confronted with as journalists, as readers, as citizens. But the other part of that is the roots of jazz go way back to black gospel and all the songs of the field hollers and slavery time. So while things ain't what they used to be, if you're a good reporter, you got to remember what the roots of everything is that you write about, because it keeps coming back.
Nat Hentoff, it's an honor to talk to you. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, sir.
Our commentators in the last few days have picked their favorite jazz, kids' music, an unknown rock record, their favorite world music, and now we turn to classical music. John Schaefer of member station WNYC says his favorite classical moment of 2008 was not on CD. It was documented on a DVD.
The funny thing about 2008 is that it really was a year not so much for releases, but for bigger news in the classical music world. And for me, the big story, which leads to the big recording of the year, was the New York Philharmonic in Pyongyang, North Korea, back in February. The orchestra rose to the occasion and played with a lot of spirit. The orchestra was clearly into it. Lorin Maazel was having a great time, even as he was clearly aware of the significance of the event. And in terms of the actual music on the program, it was an unusual choice. The Gershwin American in Paris gave Lorin Maazel a chance to crack a joke about maybe someday in the future, Americans in Pyongyang will be written. What most people don't realize is that there were actually two performances that day. There was the evening concert, which was the one that had all the dignitaries and the one that got all of the coverage. There was also an afternoon concert, which was meant to be a dress rehearsal. But in the city of Pyongyang, there was so much interest. They opened the doors and basically did their dress rehearsal as a full-on concert in front of a packed house. So I think what we have on this DVD is a slightly edited version of the evening concert with some of, some of the afternoon performance edited in to cover up some of the inevitable glitches that happen. The real moment where it all came together was at the very end of the concert, a final encore, when Lorin Maazel and the New York Philharmonic did an arrangement of the beloved Korean folk song Arirang. I don't think there was a dry eye in the house when they finished playing this piece. The audience waving to the New York Philharmonic musicians as they began to leave the stage, and then the musicians, caught by surprise, waving back with tears in their eyes. It was a remarkable moment and a true kind of meeting of cultures through this piece of music. The immediate impact of this was to put the New York Philharmonic, to put classical music on the mass media stage around the world in a way that is unparalleled in recent years. And so for me, the significance of this recording is not just great music, beautifully played, it's great music, beautifully played, and the world was watching.
John Schaefer's full list of the best classical releases of the year and the other best of 2008 lists, just go to nprmusic.org. And let's listen to some more right now.